Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. We're very excited to introduce a new series titled RLR. In this series, we try to capture the conversations that happen between myself and Robbie. We hope you enjoy.
Hey, folks, just a quick reminder that this podcast is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. Robbie, the mathematician, yeah, how are you?
Couldn't be any better. It is Sunday evening. We just moved from a tiny studio into a two-bedroom apartment, and I'm here hanging out with the one and only magician. How could it be any better? Tell me.
Well, I'll tell you. I could be watching The Last Dance right now and drinking my beer while watching The Last Dance. Instead of that, I'm drinking this Allagash white beer, and I'm about to discuss a case with you. It can't be better than this. So Robbie, I wanted to give you some closure on the case that you discussed. And just a reminder for the audience, it was a young woman with diffuse lymphadenopathy where I received a call from an outside facility requesting a transfer. And my instinct was that this is lymphoma until proven otherwise. The patient underwent an excisional lymph node biopsy. No malignancy was identified. And if you recall, your suspicion was, do you hear that alarm? So that's the potatoes in the oven. But I'll go get that after I finish the story. So your suspicion was that...
go get the potatoes, yo.
No, it's fine. Your suspicion was that this was lupus. And I want to let you know that the ANA was floridly positive with a titer of 1 to 640. The double-stranded DNA was floridly positive with very high titers, as was the anti-Smith antibody. So the patient was ultimately diagnosed with lupus, currently is on prednisone, and has follow-up scheduled.
Wow. I mean, I think it's just that journey is so humbling to go through mono, all the granulomatous diseases, multiple biopsies, and have a simple test in the internist back pocket, serology, be the thing that unravels the case. It's just so, so humbling. So humbling.
And Robbie, you know, I wanted to talk to you about this week's NEJM. We're not going to spoil the final diagnosis for anyone, but I learned like a very cool pearl. And I think it's the first time I understand the difference between episcleritis and scleritis. Episcleritis being a benign condition, scleritis potentially being a clue to a sinister systemic disease. In the paper, the discussant said, if you take phenylephrine and you inject it in the eye, if it's episcleritis, the eye becomes completely white, meaning you lose all of that red injection. If it's scleritis, you continue to see a red eye. And the reason for that is the superficial vessels constrict when you inject with phenylephrine. And so they all constrict and you see the white eye. But the deep vessels, the phenylephrine doesn't get to each of those deep vessels, so they stay dilated, so the eye remains red.
That's such an epic pearl. You know, and it makes so much a pathophysiologic sense. I just love it when you can sit back and just like intuit that every single time and don't have to memorize it, you know? I absolutely love that case. I'll tell you that the first time I really understood the difference between episcleritis and scleritis was in the ER like 2 or 3 months ago. And it just goes to show that you don't just learn from consultants. Sometimes you learn from the people who staff their front desk. Seriously. So I am in the ER where I work, we have really great access to an ophthalmologist. And I actually know the front desk folks really well there because I call a lot. And I was worried about this young patient who actually had injection. So he had a red eye without a discharge. And you think about red eye without discharge, you should worry because most conjunctivitis, the most common cause of red eye, comes with discharge. So I was like, wait, does this person has a red eye and there's no discharge? This is scleritis. And so I called over the front desk, and I don't want to reveal her name, but I called over the front desk in case she doesn't want the story out. I called over the front desk and I say her name, and she's like, oh, hi, Dr. Robbie. And, you know, I say, I'm a little worried about scleritis. I have this patient who has red eye and no discharge. And she's like, well, does he have pain? And I was like, no, not really. And he's like, oh, you know, the doctors here always say that scleritis comes with a lot of pain. And she, not the MD, over the phone without seeing the patient, essentially made the diagnosis of episcleritis with an injected eye with no discharge and not much pain. And I love that, you know, just learning that manner has helped it stick for life. And certainly reading this week's CPC reinforced that. But I just say, everyone around you in medicine is teaching you, and it can be surprise lessons from people you never expect to learn from. So thank you so hard not saying her name.
Well, listen, you can say it on the inside. Instead, since I prompted that story. I'll take full credit. Listen, Robbie, I'm going to go get the potatoes out of the oven and then I'll be right back. Okay. Give me 2 minutes.
Okay. You can stop the record button so that you don't have to.
It's okay. I'll edit it in GarageBand.
Okay. All right. You ready?
Yes, I am. The potatoes are out.
Amazing. Well, it's funny that you're talking about eating potatoes, which requires the critically important function of swallowing, which is the best segue to the case I'm about to present to you. Ready?
Please, always.
By the way, as a full disclosure for the audience, for this series, we're literally just sitting, hanging out, no documents in front of us, and we're just talking. So I'm going to present this case purely from memory. I have nothing in front of me, and if I have things wrong, I think Reza will forgive me. So, see how I left you no choice but to forgive me? So, this is a 54-year-old patient, and the first aliquot's going to be literally the only data you collect in the triage room. So, you walk into the triage room, and you see on the board that it says, hoarse voice. So, you walk in the room, and you see this middle-aged gentleman who's describing 2 to 3 days of an odd sensation in his throat. He's noticed his voice change and it's become more hoarse. And he also has had trouble swallowing both liquids and solids. This began slowly over the last couple days. He's never had anything like this before. His neurologic review of systems is otherwise negative, and he has no fevers, chills, or any inflammatory symptoms. So I'll just stop there.
That's extremely helpful. And Robbie, can I ask you one clarifying question? Did he mention to you whether the difficulty swallowing was immediate after he consumed the liquid, or was it, you know, several seconds after?
Great, great question. He actually didn't notice it start abruptly. It sort of started gradually. On him. Right. So he didn't notice it right after swallowing something, for example.
I gotcha. And I'll let the audience know why I asked that question before I jumped into thinking about this patient. What I'm trying to do is localize the site of pathology to tell if this is an oral pharyngeal dysphagia or if it's an esophageal dysphagia. With oral pharyngeal dysphagia, patients often immediately feel the challenge of swallowing food, so they start regurgitating it. With esophageal dysphagia, it might take several seconds, meaning that they have good oropharyngeal muscles, but once it gets to the center of the chest, they'll point at it and they'll say, "Doc, this is where I think the food is stuck." And that's a very important branch point in dysphagia. So right now, I'm sort of have two Venn diagrams. One is the hoarse voice and the other is the dysphagia. And if you really wanted to link these two together, there's a couple ways you can do it. The easiest way would be something in the oropharynx. Excuse me one second. I'm just going to close my email. Okay, good. Sorry about that. So something in the oropharynx. So let's talk a little bit about hoarseness. So what causes hoarseness? The most common cause is that you're yelling or you're speaking too much, where you've overused your vocal cords. Thereby, you have a hoarse voice, which my mind translates into laryngitis. Other etiologies include upper respiratory tract infections or some kind of toxic effect that might happen from smoking or alcohol. There are less common causes of hoarseness that may involve the recurrent laryngeal nerve, but we'll hold off on that. And that may become relevant because when you think about hoarseness and dysphagia, one way you can link these two together is through some kind of mass within the posterior pharynx. What would make that unusual in this case is the tempo of development of this patient's symptoms, meaning this patient was fine a week ago and suddenly is unable to swallow liquids or solids. And when you can't swallow liquids or solids and that happens simultaneously, it's more consistent with some type of motility issue rather than some type of intraluminal mass. Of course, we're going to need much more data to try to tease these apart as to where is the hoarseness originating and where is the dysphagia originating, so you can try to localize and link these two pathologies together. And ultimately, sometimes the easiest test to do is to look into the back of the throat with a laryngoscope, and there you can see exactly what's happening.
That's absolutely superb, just superb. I love the like distinction between essentially the schema of like motility versus structural, and how you use the data that you had to try to tease between those two things out. And I'll tell you what happened next was the triage nurse was already worried about this patient and gave him one of those tiny cups in the ER with just a little bit of water and asked him to drink it. And so he took a couple of sips and immediately started coughing, like within a second or two. And in reality, we actually moved to exam then before we had any more data. So we then did an exam in the triage room. And I will tell you that his neurological exam was completely normal as far as we could tell. So his extraocular movements were intact. His tongue was midline and strong. I could see symmetric elevation of his uvula. He had good sternocleidomastoid strength and had good distal sensation and good distal strength. We didn't ask him to walk at that time, and we didn't do reflexes in that moment. I'll pause there.
Yeah, that's extremely helpful information, because whenever you have a neurologic complaint or you're concerned for some type of weakness, you want to do a thorough neurologic assessment. And remember, we're dealing with the cortical bulbar tract. The same way you have the cortical spinal tract for moving your extremities, the cortical bulbar tract is responsible for moving the facial muscles. And so now you can think about the various cranial nerves that are involved in swallowing. And I believe this includes the glossopharyngeal nerve and maybe the vagus nerve and the hypoglossal nerve. So what you did, Robbie, is basically you did a cranial nerve assessment to evaluate this patient's cortical bulbar tract to see if there's a lesion in this patient's motility. And from your exam, you're not noticing any weakness or any deficit in this patient's cranial nerve. So that's an extremely helpful exam, and it helps with our differential diagnosis. Because if this was, for example, a brainstem lesion, you might get diplopia, dysphagia, dysarthria, dysphonia. But the absence of any cranial nerve deficit makes a brainstem lesion or a cortical lesion less likely. We haven't ruled out some kind of local muscular pathology or something obstructing the muscles from being able to function appropriately.
Beautiful. Okay. So because even though the exam was kind of reassuring, but the complaint was a little concerning, we asked the patient to get some blood work, basic blood work, and then moved over and studied his chart. And his chart, he had a history of PTSD and was on terazosin, had a history of depression, was on venlafaxine. And it looked like he had called the clinic and about 2 weeks prior for a diarrheal illness. He actually didn't come in. He said he had a diarrheal illness that we didn't ask him about, quite honestly, but the triage nurse had told us that completely resolved. She had seen it, that completely resolved. So I'll summarize. The background that we had to work with was PTSD, depression, terazosin and venlafaxine, diarrheal illness 2 weeks prior, and the rest of the social history and health-related behaviors didn't jump out to us.
I want to applaud your nurse for being concerned about this patient. Why? Because again, the tempo is so important. If this started abruptly, it's unlikely to reflect a structural mass because masses don't grow in a couple of days to with this rapidity, without any other symptoms of, you know, weight loss or difficulty speaking or difficulty swallowing. I would expect a slower process if we were dealing with some kind of malignancy. The one thing, when you have laryngitis and then someone unable to swallow, the question is, can they protect their airway? And this is probably the most important question to address here, even before you get into diagnoses. And when you talk about a rough onset of difficulty swallowing with hoarseness, you have to consider angioedema. And angioedema can come in various flavors, and it could affect anywhere in the GI tract, from the oropharynx, the lips, all the way into the intestines, where it can even mimic appendicitis. So this patient, we're going to use some of the background information here, is how can we use his history of diarrhea to link it to what he's presenting with now? And there's several ways where you can link diarrhea to an illness. For example, we're very familiar with Campylobacter jejuni, then causing acute inflammatory demyelinating syndrome or Guillain-Barré syndrome, or an infection causing some kind of immune response leading to some kind of adverse effect. Here, it's very difficult for me to link the diarrhea to some kind of immune response that now is manifesting in this patient's oral pharynx and his posterior oral pharynx. So the other way you can link it is if you thought about angioedema, again, we don't know what's happening within this posterior oral pharynx. Angioedema can have various manifestations, and I'm not sure, I don't have a robust illness script for angioedema of the intestines, but I wonder if that might include diarrhea. So right now, it's hard for me to incorporate the diarrhea to his abrupt onset of difficulty swallowing and hoarseness. But what I will tell you is what I'm concerned about is he able to protect his airway when you have hoarseness and difficulty swallowing? To me, that puts the lesion right above the larynx. And the first thing I would want to do is get ENT down to the emergency department to put a scope into the posterior pharynx and tell me, is there any edema? Is there anything that might be obstructing both the passage of air and the passage of food and liquid down the esophagus?
Superb. So he goes up, gets his blood work, comes back an hour later. We get in touch with ENT, who can scope him the following day. On the caveat that he stays stable in the ER for the next couple of hours. So we get basic blood work, and I'll tell you the CBC, renal panel, LFTs, ESR, CRP, TSH, CK, stone cold normal. We reassess him in the ER 2 hours later, and he's totally fine. Meaning, I should be clear, that his symptoms haven't progressed. He's still breathing well. He still coughs as soon as he has a little bit of water. His voice is so hoarse, but in the 2 hours that he was in the emergency room, there's been no acceleration of the syndrome. And so our thinking was, you know, he's been, we could call ENT to come in, but he's been stable for 3 days after the symptoms started, and we have 2 hours of stability here. So we're like, you know what, why don't you come back tomorrow, sir, we'll have ENT scope you. And so he comes back the next day. And we're ready to have ENT come by, but he tells us there's something new. He says that he has double vision now. And when you examine him, you notice two changes to the neurological exam. Now he has a bilateral cranial nerve 3 palsy with a normal pupillary size. And this time, which we didn't do last time, he has areflexia. He has no biceps reflex on both sides and no patellar reflex on both sides. And he feels very, very wobbly. The sensory exam is normal. So I'll summarize his repeat neurological exam. His chief complaint was, you know what, in addition to my hoarseness and my dysphagia, I have double vision. We do a head-to-toe neuro exam, and the notable features are bilateral cranial nerve 3 palsy, still can't see anything in the back of the throat that we can pick up on, and he has areflexia with good strength. ENT scopes him and sees paralysis of the right vocal cord with reduced excursion of the left vocal cord, but no edema.
This is extremely helpful information. The neurologic exam, whenever you perform it, what you're trying to do is you're trying to localize the lesion. Once you localize the lesion, then you can ask the question, what is causing the lesion? And then once you understand what's causing the lesion, you hope that you're able to reverse the etiology of the cause of the lesion. So in this patient, we have ataxia, right? And ataxia can be either sense pathology with sensory input into the cerebellum or with output, with motor output. You have a cranial nerve 3 palsy with normal pupils, you said, correct, Bobby? And it's bilateral. That's really important. It's not unilateral. So the fact that it's bilateral tells you that you're not, it's very unlikely you have multiple lesions within both cerebral hemispheres causing isolated bilateral CN3 palsy. So then I go from the brain and now I'm at the brainstem. Now I'm just following the cortical bulbar track. So it's brain, brainstem, peripheral nerve, CN3, neuromuscular junction, and then the muscle, correct? So if we come down to the brainstem, again, it would be quite odd for a stroke to knock out both of those nuclei that control only the third cranial nerve. What about the other cranial nerves? You know, if you think about extraocular movements, that's cranial nerves 3, 4, and 6. So this is isolated to just cranial nerve 3. So again, it would be hard for me to envision some type of mass lesion within the brainstem that just has a tropism for this specific cranial nerve. So then you're at the peripheral nerve. And at the peripheral nerve, sometimes you can get aneurysms, for example, the posterior communicating artery that can cause the CN3 palsy. But what's the chance that you have bilateral posterior communicating artery aneurysms? It's very unlikely. And it might also be helpful for me to just tell the audience, like, what is the function of the third cranial nerve in terms of extraocular movement? In terms of extraocular movement, it does medial rectus, inferior rectus, and superior rectus. And the way to remember that is that the lateral rectus is cranial nerve 6, and the superior oblique is cranial nerve 4. So if you remember those two, then everything else is cranial nerve. I should have started like that as opposed to start the harder way. And then the other thing that the cranial nerve 3 does, it carries the parasympathetic input to the pupils, causing pupillary constriction. And also is involved in stimulating one of the eyelid muscles. I think it's the levator palpebrae to keep the eyelids up. So you're telling me that the eyelids are fine, the pupils are fine, and so we're just dealing with, it seems like, the muscles of cranial nerve 3, correct? So how can we explain this cranial nerve 3 palsy? I will tell you, it doesn't sound like the brain, the cortex. It doesn't sound like the brainstem. It doesn't sound like the peripheral nerve, and it doesn't sound like the muscle. So you're left at one place, and that's a neuromuscular junction. So this sounds that it could be potentially a neuromuscular junction. I will get back to that, okay? It is possible that you can get bilateral demyelination that could affect both peripheral nerves. But I'll be honest with you, what I'm now being biased with is the preceding diarrhea. So you're telling me, and this is just pattern recognition, I'm trying a lot to be analytical in my thinking, but if you tell me someone had diarrhea, then has ataxia, ophthalmoplasia, and hyporeflexia, to me, that suggests a Miller-Fisher variant of Guillain-Barré syndrome. But the vocal cord paralysis, which is probably explaining his hoarseness, this is probably true and unrelated to what his other neurologic manifestations are, because that vocal cord being paralyzed would explain his hoarseness. I can't link that back to some kind of demyelinating condition. So what I'm focused on right now is his ataxia, the ophthalmoplegia, and the hyporeflexia. The hyporeflexia puts you at the peripheral nerve, and he's probably having impaired sensory input to his cerebellum for his proprioception, causing his ataxia. So if you tell me diarrhea and then this triad, I'd be most concerned for a demyelinating condition, specifically the Miller-Fisher variant of Guillain-Barré, which is associated with the G1Q3 antibody, I believe, in the serum.
Am I supposed to react to that? emojis are so helpful, man. I wish I could just send you the mind-blown emoji. Okay, I'm going to give you two pieces of data, and then this is the final two pieces of data, and then you'll have to commit. Okay?
You got it.
MRI, normal. LP, no pleocytosis.
But there was an albumin cytologic dissociation.
I hate you so much. Yes. And you want to explain to the audience what that means?
Absolutely. Because I was going through a very circuitous.
Circuitous?
Circuitous, thank you. I was going through a circuitous.
It takes two CP solvers to do that.
I was going through a circuitous process trying to explain an isolated bilateral CN3 multi. So when you have this diarrhea, and it's not only with Campylobacter, it could be other organisms, you get an immune response. This immune response leads to demyelination. And demyelination within the central nervous system manifests as elevation in the protein. So when you say albuminocytologic dissociation, you're saying that there are no cells to suggest meningitis, but there's elevated proteins that suggest demyelination. And so that would further support the possibility of Guillain-Barré syndrome, specifically the Miller-Fisher variant, associated with G1Q3B antibody.
So, neurology came down and saw the patient and was very concerned that he did in fact have the Miller-Fisher variant of Guillain-Barré syndrome and started him on treatment with IVIG and sent off the CQ1B antibody, which later returned positive. He actually did really well. So Miller-Fisher was a working diagnosis and supported strongly by the fact that he got better with IVIG, and then the antibody actually returned like 3 or 4 days later. And he actually had a complete recovery. It took a while, but I think a week or two later, he was back to baseline, absolutely no issues whatsoever.
That's unbelievable. And I think a very important pearl for the listeners out there is when you have Guillain-Barré or an acute inflammatory demyelinating polyradiculopathy, hyporeflexia is part of this illness script. So if you don't have hyporeflexia, you should question at least the diagnosis of Guillain-Barré. I'm not sure about the Miller-Fisher variant, if that's different or not, and I'd love to learn from you, Robbie. But if you don't have hyporeflexia, you're probably not dealing with Guillain-Barré. And we know that the typical Guillain-Barré is sort of an ascending paralysis where you could have sensory symptoms as well and hyperreflexia, and you worry that the respiratory muscles become compromised. So that's why these patients need to be monitored closely. And why do we give IVIG? We give IVIG because we just said you've activated this immune system that's demyelinating the nerves leading to this patient's clinical syndrome. So how can you prevent the demyelination from happening? Well, given a medication that binds the antibody or the immune system that's causing the DMI, and that's where IVIG comes in. You can also do plasmapheresis, but I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think generally the response takes some time. Like, you don't expect a response within a couple of days. This might take weeks, but what I don't know is how long are you supposed to monitor these patients in the hospital with the fear of respiratory compromise and hypercarbic respiratory failure?
You know, Reza, I don't know if I have much to add to that, but honestly, I think that those are all concerns that are way heavily on a neurologist's mind. And like, honestly, I don't have that level of expertise to know, and I'm very glad that they took the patient and cared for him. I'll tell you what I learned from this case. I'll tell you one thing, and I'd love to maybe just reflect on a couple other things. It's the first time I've ever thought of the value of a reflex exam with no weakness. Because I think in retrospect, if we had tested reflex on the first day, like he came in, he had no diplopia, but had the hoarseness and the dysphagia. He was strong in his extremities, so we didn't do reflexes. But I have a hard time believing that he lost his reflexes in one day. Because he was still weak. He was still, he still in his extremities had normal strength, but had no reflex. And so I don't understand that all too well, to be honest with you. It's a gap in my knowledge. But it goes to show that sometimes the reflex exam can be helpful, even in the absence of weakness. And so how do you, how is that actionable? Like, do you do a patellar reflex on everybody with a normal strength exam? I don't think so. But if you have an unclear neurologic syndrome, like you have a patient with hoarseness and dysphagia that it appears oropharyngeal because he coughs the moment he swallows, that might be a good time to be like, I don't have a good handle on the neuro status, and I'm going to do everything. I'm going to do the gait assessment, I'm going to do the mental status assessment, and I'm going to do the reflex assessment, even if the patient isn't weak. So that's one, that was one takeaway for me.
Robbie, that's absolutely beautiful. And I think another pearl is the triple or four Ds associated with brainstem dysfunction, which I sort of labeled when I was discussing this case. So if you have dysphagia, dysphonia, dysarthria, diplopia, you can assume that something's happening at the brainstem, whether it's a stroke, a mass, a bleed. Question for you. The vocal cord, was the paralysis, was that also because of demyelination? Really? Which cranial nerve?
I think it's
a vagus. Recurrent. Yeah, it's a vagus. That's right.
I think the recurrent laryngeal is off the vagus, right?
So that's why his vocal cord was... Everyone, Robbie is just always too nice, where I said it's true and unrelated, and he didn't correct me. So that was that was demyelination. And because you're losing input into the vocal cord, then you get paralysis, and then you get the hoarseness from there. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I'm not 100% sure. But I think the recurrent laryngeal comes off the vagus nerve.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. Yeah, Google that, folks. By the way, this is the price of spontaneous discussion. Trust nothing.
I was gonna go back to episcleritis versus scleritis, something I know something about.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a final question to leave the audience with.
Please.
If you as an internist hear acute stuff going on, acute neuro stuff going on in the face, what is your reflex checklist? Like, what two or three diagnoses do you reflexively think of when you have, as an internist, not an expert, of like there's either ophthalmoplegia or dysphagia or something like that that's neurologic in origin? Miller-Fisher belongs on there. Any other rapid associations that you have?
Absolutely. And by the way, when you said reflex, it was hard for me to focus because we just talked about the importance of reflexes.
It's on my mind. I'm sorry.
Well, honestly, if you and let's do a cognitive autopsy to answer your question. Why was I so focused on the neuromuscular junction? Because when you start talking about, you know, ptosis, ocular pathology, weakness of the facial muscles, I automatically start thinking about myasthenia gravis. I think about the Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, and I think about botulinum. And so that's why when you started mentioning a CN3 palsy, I forgot about the ataxia and the hyporeflexia. And later, as I was going down that, you know, neuro axis, I was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to explain the cerebellar issues, and how am I going to explain the hyporeflexia? And that's when I thought about the Miller-Fisher. But to answer your question specifically, I think a stroke, I think myasthenia, and I think of those neuromuscular disorders.
Amazing. Yo, should we leave folks with a teaser?
Of course. And when he says,
I don't have one,
he means Reza and folks.
No. Do you have a teaser? I don't have a teaser.
Oh, you don't have a teaser.
No, I can think of one if you want, but you should have a teaser. Because last time you left these folks with a mega teaser, which was the DX for the case.
Okay, let me think if I have a teaser. Okay, here is your teaser. which exam, we've been talking a lot about cranial nerves. What's one finding that will distinguish between sympathomimetic toxicity and anticholinergic toxicity?
So good. Let's make sure to answer that next time.
I don't know the answer to that.
It's okay. We can count on Tony Brew to answer all our questions for us.
Oh my gosh, I forgot to record.
No, I'm just joking. I see you recording, man.
That's a wrap, folks.